Hey everybody, welcome to the Sharp Tongue Podcast. I'm your girl, Jessie Mae Peluso. Another day, another dollar. You ready to listen to this bitch holler? Hey, I am so pumped. This is such a jam-packed week for myself. It's finally come to fruition. So many things I've been working on that I could have never accomplished without your support and your continued support. Please tell your friends about the podcast. Let them know to rate and review us. Share it with anybody who you think would enjoy it, benefit from it, learn, grow, be motivated and inspired, because that's my goal with this podcast. And I think we're achieving that. I know we are. I feel it. I read it. I read all the messages, well, most of the messages between myself and Debbie. We are eyes and ears on the ground with you guys. So thank you so much. I appreciate you. We made it to 10,000 subscribers on the YouTube page. I know that sounds like such a small number, but I started with 1,000 in the beginning of the year. And I just think that's a huge accomplishment. I had never really put as much effort into YouTube as I should have, probably, according to people who are making millions of dollars off of the site. But my goal is never to make money off of what I do. It's to make an impact, and hopefully I can have a good living as well. But my good living consists of adopting animals and sucking Brad Pitt's dick. So, you know, tomato, tomato. I honestly appreciate you so much. And I am so excited about the 10,000 subscribers. And make it more. My goal for the end of the year is 100,000. So I think we can, not by the end of the year, within a year. Fuck it, by the end of the year. No, by next year. Having 100,000 subscribers. Fuck it, 1 million by the end of next year. I just really made it a very ambitious goal. By the end of 2022, I want a million subscribers. All the mycelium in the ground. What is going on? Shrooms every day with my coffee. Take a breath. I feel like I said all of that on one breath. And it's because I'm running on gratitude. Is that cheesy? Sounds like something Matthew McConaughey says in the morning. All right, all right, all right. This brother is energized by Jesus and gratitude. I truly am. There's so much happening this week. First of all, it's the kickoff of my personal tour, Wide Open. We're starting this Sunday in Austin, Texas. I will be going to visit my buddy Rogan, filming Rogan on Friday, and then doing one show in Austin, Texas, August 1st. At Full Can Gas Company. One show, one night, your girl. Check it out. JessieMae.com for tickets. Wide Open Tour is coming to ya. We are coming to Connecticut, New Jersey, Minneapolis, Minnesota, Key West, Florida. I have the list right here. So many places. Alaska, British Columbia, Alberta, Canada. Excuse me. New York City with Carly. Our girl tour has kicked off as well. My girl Carly Aquilino, we're doing a few dates together. I'll also be in Sacramento, California. Providence, Rhode Island. Poughkeepsie, New York. Atlanta, Georgia. Back in Austin, Texas with Carly. Atlanta with Carly. Key West, Florida. Plano, Texas. Minneapolis, Minnesota. Ending the year in Syracuse, New York, and I also am squeezing in a San Francisco date in there somewhere. JessieMae.com for tickets, for the Wide Open Tour, and for the Girl Tour. Girl is featuring my girl, Carly Aquilino. Her and I will be on tour together. I'm so excited. All this stuff I've been working on in quarantine is coming together. Our girl podcast, GYRL, Giving You Real Life, that's what it stands for. That podcast should be out by the end of July, beginning of August. And our tour dates are available, so you can come see us do stand-up. And we're going to be recording our podcast live as well. I may do some live Sharp Tongues from the road. I'm not sure yet. But for now, it's just a girl tour with Carly and I where we're going to be recording live podcasts. And the Wide Open Tour is just featuring myself. And any dates you see with Carly build on there is our girl tour, just to make it all simple and easy. And also, you guys, my Netflix show is airing on Wednesday. Oh my God. I hosted a show for Netflix. We filmed it in quarantine while I was losing my mom. I could get into a whole episode with you guys, and I'll do a solo episode. It's been a hot minute, but this week isn't that. But I'll get into all the emotions surrounding everything that I've worked on this past year and it coming together this week. It just feels so intense in good ways and bittersweet in other ways. You know, huge dreams of mine are coming true, and the two most important people in my life aren't physically here. So I need you guys. And as vulnerable as that is, I think it's okay to say, I need you to come out and support. Tell your friends to come out and support my Netflix show. Please binge it. Binging is the way to get a season two. So binge the fuck out of it. It's called Tattoo Redo. It comes out July 28th, this Wednesday. It was filmed by Best Production Company, Kevin Bartel. We had Chris Nunez on staff. Amazing tattoo artist. Miriam Lupini, Tommy Montoya, Twig Sparks, Matt Berkerich, and am I missing? I feel like I'm missing somebody. Oh, Rose Hardy, my girl Rose Hardy. All of us worked in quarantine. We worked our asses off and put together this really fun fucking show for you. It's called Tattoo Redo. Check it out. My tour, Wide Open, premiering this week in Austin, Texas. Check it out. August 1st at Volcan Gas Company. I'll be on Rogan. Also, Girl Tour is kicked off. Get your dates. Coming to New York City, October 9th. Atlanta, November 13th. In Austin, Texas, November 18th to the 20th with Carly Aquilino. Also, live podcast recordings. And I'm here this week on this podcast that I love so much with somebody who is very inspiring. My guest this week is Chair of the Lenox Hill Neurosurgery and a neurosurgeon. He also is the star of Lenox Hill on Netflix. Hey, Netflix brother. He is the founder of Playback Health and also a mentor of a group he's dubbed the Brain Turns. He's doing so much for neurosurgery, especially for bringing females into the industry, and he really wants to create more of a space where women can become neurosurgeons because we aren't as heavily represented in this industry. So I had such a great conversation. I sat down with this guy. We shared a tequila and talked basically about tequila and brain surgery. Please welcome my guest, neurosurgeon, Dr. David Langer. Sharp Tongue Podcast. Beep, 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 beep. You're listening to the Sharp Tongue Podcast. I'm your host, Jessie Mae Peluso.
It's a personal
look. Well, it's not really a look because it's a podcast. I'm already fucking this up.
This is kind of like a verbal comedy diary,
a deep look into the crevices of my mind. It's going to get dirty.
You might cry.
You'll probably laugh.
Hopefully you'll laugh.
The whole point is for you to laugh, but you also might cry. I talk about my family. I talk about farts. I talk about love, loss, comedy, how hard it is to make it in this biz. I'm a fucking professional. Each week it's something different. Sometimes I have a guest host. Sometimes it's going to be a movie companion episode. Sometimes I just ramble about the bullshit I dealt with the week before. You never know what you're going to get. It's raw, uncut, and funny. It's me. Dr. Langer, we have started recording. And prior to us starting, you and I had a little chit chat. And, you know, sometimes I'll enjoy a little something, something on the podcast, you know. A little, maybe marijuana. We're not sure. My house is filled with it. Anyways, I have my tequila.
Oh, that's a good one. That's the cucumber jalapeno. I think we have one of those.
This
is a good one. Yeah.
It's a really good one. And I'm trying to get them to sponsor the pod. So 21 seeds.
Love 21 seeds. Yeah. We just take Casamigos and just put peppers into it.
Yeah. See, people are really sleeping on the pepper effect with tequila. Yeah. It really does. It helps your neurons fire more.
There's no question. It is the best drink.
You came into my life during a time when my sister and I were binging on Netflix, and on the heels of me educating myself about Alzheimer's and the effects of and things that you do to your life to make yourself more susceptible. And then we found your show, and my sister was obsessed, and she's like, you need to have him on the podcast because you already talk about brain stuff, but also because he's kind of dreamy. And I was like, okay, back up. He's married happily with a beautiful wife and children. Here you are.
Yeah.
And I want to thank you for taking time out because I would imagine being a chair on the chair and a neurosurgeon is a very busy life.
Yeah. I mean, I don't really look at it. I love what I do. And there some days suck, but for the most part, I enjoy my work. So I don't really look at it as work. It's really been super. I have fun most of the time.
Well, so today we're having fun. So cheers to Tequila Fridays. Thank you for joining us. Yeah.
You look like you have fun also, by the way. Probably a lot more fun than I do.
Well, let's just say this. If I sneeze, no one's going to die.
I hope that doesn't happen to me.
You know, your job, your career and calling, I think it's more, you know, obviously you and I are similar in the sense that we have found something that we feel we were put on earth to do. Or something that called to us to pursue. But it's interesting that you say, you know, we both love what we do. What is one of the things you love most about your job and your career and what you do for a living?
It's evolved, honestly. You know, I think I was originally attracted just the magnificent surgery. It's actually gotten better because of this exoscope that was in the show, this video. We operate off of a sort of large screen now. It's this 4K, high definition 3D, and so all of a sudden, this kind of the beauty of neuroanatomy, which is the reason why I love neurosurgery, is open for everyone. It's just been an extraordinary experience to use this thing. But that's kind of at the end. You know, the beginning was you just wanted to do great cases. You know, save lives. You know, very idealistic. It's a lot of work. A lot of pain and suffering. Over time, the whole Lennox experience sort of opened up another side of me for sure. That luckily enough was sort of, I still am an evolution, but it sort of came out during the show, I think, of kind of this transition from being a leading neurosurgeon to be a neurosurgical leader. And, you know, anybody, it's not easy to be like a top anything, whether it's in, you know, radio broadcaster, comedian, podcast maker. That takes, you know, a certain skill, a certain talent. It's very selfish. Certainly in entertainment, there's a lot of narcissism and me, and you have to promote yourself. And, you know, neurosurgery is really not that different. But I think to make this transition to building a group and a culture and really having a larger imprint, it sort of started around the time of the Netflix filming, and it's morphed into something that's extraordinary, been really a very challenging thing to make that transition from always worrying about yourself and how cool the cases you're doing to making sure your junior guys or your partners are supported and that they are as excited about what they're doing as you are. And I still struggle with it sometimes, to be honest, to be totally vulnerable, because I still love to operate, but you know, you get what you reap what you sow. And when you give things up and you are comfortable with it or uncomfortable with it, you it's surprising the result. And so I'm still in that phase right now. So, you know, I still love the operating room and I still love pushing my envelope and doing challenging things. I've become, as I've gotten older, I've really appreciated the value of a straightforward case done well, you know, that just helping somebody. But I really do enjoy the mentorship and being creative. I have an IT project, really thinking out of the box about how to impact healthcare and, you know, trying to laugh a little bit at the same time. Those are all important.
They are. And you bring up something that really, I don't want to say that is missing in your field, but as somebody from the other side, as someone who would be a patient looking in from my perspective, you bring up the point of adding some compassion to your approach. And you would think someone getting into the healthcare industry, whether it's a doctor, an RN, or anesthesiologist, whatever the title is, that there would be just standard an approach with compassion, but that's not always the case. And you are, I hate to say you're a unicorn, but I think you are a unicorn. I just from watching you on the show and listening to your approach on how you're building your team with you, your partner, Dr. Bukvar, and your whole team, you guys seem to take a very collaborative and compassionate approach to each individual that you see. And as much as it's probably very encouraging to get a case where somebody's willing to, you know, put themselves on the line as a guinea pig for a new drug or a new technique, you still manage to treat them as humans. And I would think that would be a really hard differentiation to make as a professional, to look at an individual and want to dissect them and look at them on a molecular level, but also maintain that they are someone's mother, someone's father. Is that something that you came into this career with, or is that something you developed along your path, especially at Lenox Hill, because you, it seemed like you built that place up from the brick to the ceiling. I'm wondering if that, if your compassion is something that is what drove you, or did it come to you in the process of your career?
That's a big question.
I know. I ask big questions.
I'm going to play a little game.
I tell dick jokes, but I ask big questions.
I'm going to play a little game with you.
Okay.
You have cancer.
Shit, doc.
Bad game. You're gonna survive, and you're gonna have a choice. Your choice is, I want to live with 100% certainty, or I'm gonna live with 50% certainty. Which would you choose?
Like 100%. I want the
100%. Okay, so the surgeon that's gonna give you 100% chance of survival is a dick.
Wow.
He doesn't give a shit about you. He doesn't even see you after surgery. You're in some clinical trial and you did well, but he doesn't. He just wants the data. He wants the stats. He wants to get promoted. And it's a guy, and he's got a bow tie, and he's an asshole.
I can't stand him.
You have another person, maybe not a male, maybe somebody who's more empathetic, who maybe it is a male. Let's say it's a male. And he cares about you. He's empathetic. He listens. He gives the information, but he's not as good of a surgeon, and his team isn't as good, and he's not as demanding. And you only have a 50% chance of survival with that super nice guy. Who do you choose?
Oh, man. Judging on my dating history, I would go with the asshole.
Of course. Think about women choose assholes a lot.
All the time. We love a good fixer-upper,
yeah,
Doc. Love a good fixer-upper.
Right. Well, I think that's a game, but also respect the fact that in healthcare, you're not getting paid to be empathetic. It's a business. There's very little upside sometimes. A lot of people ask me in the Who Saw Me in the Show, like, how do you, like, a lot of my like colleagues say, you know, I could never be like that with my patients. I mean, like, why not? You know, I think in the end, I think that there's, I don't think you really can teach empathy. And empathy is different than sympathy or compassion.
Yep.
You can't really teach it. I've had, you know, some of my life experiences, and I think just the way I was born, I'm the oldest of three boys. I've always been kind of the adult in the room, but you know, also I've had real struggles with my family, with my first marriage, with my kids. And I, you know, those struggles have made me a different kind of person. My father passed away when he was young, like sounds like yours did.
So young. And your dad was 45.
Yeah. But, you know, everybody has a story. I feel I'd gain a lot from that. You know, I remember when it first happened, I felt so badly for myself, but, you know, I didn't deserve this. All that crap you use. And, you know, there's somebody who's dad died when they were 44, or there's somebody who never had a dad, or there's someone who never knew their father, or their dad was an asshole, or, you know, whatever, or both parents died. You know, it's there's always someone has it worse than you do. And there's lots of people that have it better, but I always use the metaphor of never looking out of the boat. I say I was a rower in college. I learned a lot from that experience. My college experience was, I was rowing and training from fall through the following spring. We didn't do some of the things other people did. I was studying and rowing, and it was just an incredible experience of this personal sacrifice for the better of a team. And the not looking out of the boat thing is a metaphor. It's like when you're racing in a crew boat, you're looking at where you've been, you don't see the finish line, and you don't never look at your competition because it takes your eyes off the work. And it's how I live. And I don't give a crap what anybody else is doing. And if other people aren't empathetic, and if they choose to be great surgeons without recognizing that the reason why we go and to become doctors is to help people, and that it's just saving people and helping people are it. You know, I give a talk on this stuff. Do you know who Margaret Mead was?
The name rings a bell, but I can't pull anything. Who was she?
So she was kind of the Oprah Winfrey of the 1960s and 70s. She was an anthropologist, sociologist who, you know, she was like very vocal in the press and was like the go-to woman for, you know, anthropology, sociology, very well known. She wrote a number of books. And
I hate that I know Kim Kardashian and not Margaret Mead.
Yeah, well, there you go.
I really hate that I know that.
You would know Margaret Mead if she was alive now, because she'd be hot on Insta. But but she, there's a story, it's apocryphal, of a student asking Margaret Mead what she saw as the first sign of civilization. And since she was an anthropologist, it's like, of course she's going to say something like, you know, wall caving, you know, carvings on a wall, or, you know, some pictures of horses or hooks or stone, you know, carving stones or weapons. And she said, no, the first sign of civilization was when she found a human being with a healed femoral fracture, or broken leg. Because if you survived with a broken leg, that means someone carried you, protected you from wild beasts. And because in the animal world, if you break your leg, you die. You're attacked by predators. And so that the real sign of civilization is basically that someone's caring for one another, and to have compassion, and then saving a person's life or helping someone else is where civilization starts. And I really find that to be, you know, for me, especially through COVID, was seared into me. And between the Netflix experience and just the evolution of medicine for me personally, the Lennox experience, the people I've, you know, come into contact with, along with reading and trying to understand myself, and then going through what I saw in New York City in 2020, and then reading things like Margaret Mead, I think that I've changed, and I feel lucky. You know, I get bummed out sometimes when there are a lot of days that, because the rest of the world doesn't necessarily recognize some of the things that I find important. It's very hard, but you have to keep your head in the boat and keep doing what you're doing, and eventually it should be okay.
It's a interesting thing that I witnessed, the juxtaposition from being in the hospital to going to those New York City streets. And you kind of spoke about it, and it sort of touches on my question on how do you balance it? Because you are a chairman, you are head of a department and a surgeon, and also a husband and a dad. It may seem, you know, easy to just shut it off, but I would imagine your line of work, especially being centered around the brain, it must be hard to shut it off when you go home. How do you balance it? How do you shut it off? Is it just like today on your beach, at your beach house, having a tequila with me? Is this considered shutting it off?
Yeah, I'd like to think so. I mean, I look forward to talking to people about our world. The incredible thing about Lenox Hill, I think if you're a city person, which not everybody's a city person,
Yeah,
so the location's got to be there can't be a city, a hospital better positioned geographically in the world. Most hospitals are there's kind of a lot of space around the hospital because they're large, and there's a lot of, you know, room between the sort of civilian, you know, commercial life and the hospital world. And Lenox is literally one, it's a city block, and then there's a bar across the street, you know, that's our, it's like our Lenox cafeteria. And, you know, there's a bagel store and a bum on the corner, and there's like, you know, this really good falafel place and taxis and the cacophony of Park Avenue in New York City. I think that there's no question I thrive in that. I wasn't really a New Yorker born and raised. I came late, but I love working in New York. And it was even better during COVID. And Lenox, being in Lenox, and it's very hard to, you know, when you're at other hospitals that don't have that milieu, both in and out, and the diversity and just the stress and just the craziness of it all. I'm not saying it's good all the time, but you kind of miss it. It's like, you know, driving your car to work and pulling to a parking lot and walking into a place that's kind of quiet. Everybody looks the same. And, you know, there are a lot of people who thrive in that, but they don't, because they couldn't imagine going through what we go through every day. But I can't imagine not doing it. And I struggle because I know that's probably give something of yourself by doing that. Life could be a lot easier. I don't think there's such a thing as balance. I mean, you know, my feeling is you make decisions in life about your partner and your career. That's really the biggest two decisions of your life. And
you're right.
having children, but that's more of a different decision. But, you know, if your partner knows you well enough and you really have a good relationship, they respect the fact of what makes you happy. And by the same token, if you don't choose a good career, if you choose something for money or for power or for the wrong reasons, you aren't happy because you're chasing something that is not really what you want. And I'm lucky that I decided to become a doctor. Becoming a neurosurgeon is actually, deciding what kind of doctor to be is actually more important than going to medical school, to be quite honest, because there's what I do and like what a pediatrician does are a difference between me and a Wall Street guy, basically. But in the end, I think that I just look at it as balance. It starts with these decisions, and that I made a mistake in my first marriage. I didn't have any balance. I was unhappy. And even though I was still happy at work, I didn't want to go home, and I was, struggling with that. So now that I have the balance of having these two pieces of my life, for the most part, where I want them, I have that balance. Now, it doesn't mean I have, complete balance everything all the time. There's a neurosurgeon who put this like a divided up your life into a square, into four compartments: your career, your marriage, your family, your religion, and your health. Mm. And then if you think about it, it goes off sometimes where you spend more. It's sometimes a quadrilateral, sometimes it's a quadrilateral, it's all always four sides, but it morphs and shapes. The key is keeping that thing kind of square. And I think it really, though, I mean, I try to keep healthy. I'm not particularly religious, but I like the kind of Buddhist concept of the way of life. And I think that basically it begins with finding ways to be creative and push your envelope, be willing to fail in your career and learn, and then having a relationship at home that you have unconditional love. And if you can find that, that's balance.
I think that's a perfect way to put it. There are ebbs and flows everywhere in life, and nothing's perfect. And you, as long as you can remain flexible and communicate what your goals are with a supportive partner, it sounds amazing. And I can't wait to relay that to Brad Pitt, because he's going to be in my marriage chamber.
Is he next? Is he following me?
Of course he is. Yeah, sure. He's after you.
That's right.
I feel like, honestly, I could spend 4 hours with you because I want to know everything there is about the brain. Now, to pivot a little bit, when it comes to Alzheimer's, it's such a hard disease to diagnose first. I feel like its early symptoms get jumbled into other things, and it becomes, by the time the disease has set its claws in, it's already done the damage it's going to do, and it's underway to an inevitable end. But for someone who studies the brain, what are some things that maybe the public, general public, could know or should know with this disease? Like, are there other signs? Is there ways to know for sure it's Alzheimer's early on? Or do we need to be in your office and see your scans on a daily basis?
Well, you should never confuse a neurosurgeon with studying the brain.
Yes. I know you chop into the brain, but I'm talking from like a physical aspect. Like,
well, the truth of the matter is Alzheimer's is a neurological disease, not a neurosurgical one. But I still have, I have an understanding of it. There's no therapy for Alzheimer's. All these new drugs are coming out. There'll probably be something in our lifetime. Respect the fact that as we age, our organs deteriorate. And so some aspect of Alzheimer's is just normal aging. So when people lose their memory or aren't quite as sharp when they're 80, then there's some people who carry their full-on intelligence and personality up until, they die in their hundreds. Those are unique people. But the majority of us, the mortal people in the world, lose a step or two. Our knees get, crickety, and our back hurts, and
my knees sound like there's metal in the fucking microwave.
Yeah. So there you go. And not to mention, what men have to take, their pills to keep things going. I mean, these are all it's part of getting older. And the brain is the same way. So there's an element of this kind of progressive dementia that's normal. It's when it becomes accelerated or severe early that we start thinking about Alzheimer's. And Alzheimer's is a diagnosis. It's a neurodegenerative disease that causes disruptions in cognition, memory in particular. And we know what the cells look like pathologically, but you can't diagnose it without people essentially being dead. because you can't take a piece of the brain and you don't need to do biopsies for Alzheimer's disease. It's really a clinical diagnosis. It's got a certain signature clinically where a neuropsychologist can study you and put you through a battery of a personality test, basically. And there are certain kind of signs of Alzheimer's. I think we're not going to, as far as diagnosing it, it's still a clinical diagnosis, meaning, you know, you're doing X, Y, and Z, and you have it. And then what do we do? And then the scans show a fair amount of brain atrophy. But it's a scary proposition for people, especially who have it in their family, because, and there are the Parkinson's, Huntington's, there are all these neurodegenerative diseases, they're just terrible. And I think that in the end, part of it, we probably will be getting better at diagnosing susceptibility, meaning determining what your genetic susceptibility is to it, and then begin to find things that will have impact your susceptibility, meaning whether it's diet or drugs or, you know, something, either environmental, that we can modify to sort of mitigate your genes. And, you know, we do this with heart disease. You know, if you have high cholesterol, you have a cholesterol medication. If you have, you shouldn't smoke, we have things we do all the time to impact our health. And hopefully these types of things will help us to mitigate the effects of these neurodegenerative diseases. I do think that just healthy living, you know, limiting your, you know, exercise, you know, good balanced diet,
tequila,
a daily
intake.
Tequila.
Very
helpful.
A little bit goes a long way.
Totally. Don't not have fun. I mean,
you know, I had this conversation. I had a psychiatrist on, Dr. Daniel Amen, and he essentially has scanned my brain and deduced a lot of information that has made me pivot my life. One of which being alcohol intake, which I have to be honest, I drank more as a teenager than I do as an adult because I live in LA now and marijuana is life. That being said, I know you are a neurosurgeon and there are differences between that and somebody who actually is studying like the brain on a level of, you know, it being a neurodegenerative disease. But when it comes to alcohol and marijuana, can you tell me if someone had to choose one to have for the rest of their life, is there one that would be less damaging?
Marijuana. Next question.
We got the clip, Deb.
It's not even a question. I mean, alcohol is terrible. First of all, it's addictive. Marijuana is not. People do stupid shit on alcohol. I mean, men get get aggressive, and there's abuse. There's people drive. You know, it's all terrible.
And then women sleep with those abusive men.
Exactly.
On alcohol.
Think about. I mean, the whole fraternity world, and I mean. It's a mess. So
it is a mess.
Both from a social, biological, and medical situation, alcohol is far worse and will always be. First of all, there's huge companies that sell the stuff, and it's basically just, and it's accepted by our society. You know, it's like it's never going to go away. You know, marijuana was originally a black drug, and it was really discriminated against partially because of that. And you know, I think marijuana has been shown to be very safe. Now, anything, it can be bad, and if you use too much of it. And I think the edible problem is that people just eat it too much, and then they lose control themselves.
Shit.
It can be really bad. Yeah.
Had anybody come in? They're like, my brain is dying.
I know. Yeah, I've known some people very close to me that it's happened to. But
it's terrible.
In the end, yeah, it's really bad. But I think that making it legal and having a commercial, you know, commercial business around it is only likely to make it more safe and more controlled and less risky because it'll be kind of more kind of normal. And there's no question. No question that marijuana is safer than alcohol. Now, there are some people who would argue there are studies that it could affect memory and can be negative for the brain, but this stuff's all pretty atmospheric right now. And frankly, I don't think there's been enough study on it. Undoubtedly there will be, but there's no question that alcohol is terrible for you. I mean, your liver, your brain, you know, everything, diabetes, it's just like, you know, so I agree with you. Like I drank a lot more during COVID. You know, I would come home at night and all of a sudden I'm having like, you know, 20 drinks a week. And I wasn't.
What was your go-to? Was it tequila?
Yeah, pretty much. I like my wife and I went to Russia in 2019, and I became a big vodka drinker. So, but yeah, vodka's good. When you know,
vodka, I like a good martini. You can do anything with vodka. You can put it with a little tomato juice. You can do a little grapefruit.
Yeah,
you could just spritz it on your face with your mouth open. I mean,
you could. Yeah,
literally,
absolutely.
There's so many variations to ingesting and drinking vodka.
But you got to be careful. I mean, I've cut back quite a bit.
I try as well. Yeah. It's hard, you know, like you said, like especially in quarantine, you're left to your own vices and in your own thoughts, which can drive you to your vices.
How did you get into your business?
I just wouldn't shut up. And so I just went to a place where I could do that and it become something lucrative.
Yeah.
I think I just always, you know, growing up, there's a lot of chaos in my house. My parents had a tumultuous marriage and a more amicable separation, but the result of that was me entertaining my sister, I think, to sort of deviate from the chaos in the household. She was my first audience member. And and I always think about that, you know, it was just her and I, and I think the pure joy and connectivity that I experienced in those moments of making her laugh was my drug. I couldn't get enough of it.
Making people laugh is a skill. I mean, and even when we're talking, you get such a kick out of making someone laugh.
Yeah, it feels good.
Yeah, and I think I think comedians, I was just talking to somebody yesterday about it, how, you ever hear of a guy named Foster Brooks speaking about alcohol? Do you know who Foster Brooks was? Oh my God.
You keep bringing up people who I'm like, I know who that is.
Foster Brooks plays a drunk with Dean Martin. And you got to look this guy up.
God.
There's one skit where he plays a brain surgeon at a bar. It's one of the greatest ones. You know, he said, what are you doing? He goes, Dean Martin plays a straight guy smoking. You know, this is on TV. So what do you do? He goes, I'm a brain surgeon. You know, and he goes, I'm heading back to the hospital now. And he kind of walks out of the, you know. And you couldn't make that joke today.
No, you couldn't, because you get canceled.
Yeah, but you got to see, the evolution. And also I'm so interested in sort of, did you see the CNN things on stand-up, the history of stand-up, or even on the late night, the history of late night? And you see how comedy sort of evolved and culturally, and it's really reflects back on, you know, what people are thinking. And I lived in England for a year, and British humor is totally different than America. Like Jerry Seinfeld, it's harder for him to be funny in England. And it's just so much. And that's why there are black comedians and Asian comedians and when Jewish comedians and women and men. And it's just so interesting to see, but ultimately it's, you just really get a charge out of making people laugh. And
you do.
It's awesome. It's great.
Also like
your Instagram posts made me laugh.
That's right. I told you, I was like, you better say that in our conversation. I made a neurosurgeon laugh.
They're great.
I struggle with sometimes wanting to have more purpose, and I've worked on realizing that my purpose is to, as simple and simplistic as it sounds, to bring joy to people. And, you know, when it comes to those last moments, which I'm sure you've been around too many than you that you like to admit, being in someone's last moments, you'd hope there was some joy in their heart. You'd hope they would recollect or recall something that brought them joy. And if I can be just a small part of that, to me, now I realize the value of it, and I don't need to excuse it anymore. You know, I think also where you and I are similar is, and I mentioned it before, our drive to do what we do was brought on by both of our fathers. Essentially, I got into stand-up because of my dad, and I got into my desire to learn more about the brain because of his passing. And you got into, I believe you got into neurosurgery you were looking basically an eternal search to cure your father.
That's true.
And how many days, or when you wake up in the morning, is that on the top of your head, or is it something that you just sort of have as a barometer or a compass to still keep you going? You know, is it still in the forefront of your drive that you are looking to cure your dad? I think that's a beautiful motivator to do something for other people.
Yeah, I wasn't particularly close with my dad. I respected him. He worked so hard. And I sort of feel like sometimes maybe I'm just reinventing my father with my own kids, oddly enough. But he was brilliant, and he was a great doctor. And when he got sick, he had a heart attack when he was 42. And he just had a stroke when he was 45. And he didn't die until he was 52, actually. But his life was ruined. But I got to know him in many ways much better after he had a stroke, because he was so vulnerable. And he became he became like my brother. You know, he needed me. I needed to pick him up and clean him and get him, you know, help him get to work. And he would pee in himself. I had to go find a pair of pants for him and this kind of thing.
How old were you at this point?
I was 23 when he had strokes. He died when I was 30.
So between those years, you were
I was a resident.
Close.
I was a resident, neurosurgery resident then. I was in medical school then, a resident. He died when I was a third year resident. But, you know, in the end, I always wanted to be kind of like him. I wanted to be a cardiologist. Then I thought I wanted to be a cardiac surgeon. But I was drawn to neurosurgery without, you know, I agree with you. It's no question I had this kind of interest in neurological impairment because of him. And then I ended up doing vascular neurosurgery, which is all blood vessels and stroke. Oddly enough, stroke it destroyed my mom's life in particular, and our family life, because of my father's, you know, suffering. And then fast forward, you know, 20 years later, the stroke treatment has really radically altered vascular neurosurgery. So that all the open surgery that I love to do, that I train to do, has sort of disappeared because of all the catheter-based treatment. And that's been, for me, a big it's been terrible. You know,
it has to be very difficult to adjust.
Yeah,
different departments.
Yeah, I went and did a fellowship 10 years after my residency. The whole field was changing. And I used to fly to Buffalo, you know, every Tuesday night or Wednesday morning, and work in Buffalo for 3 days a week as a fellow, and to learn the catheter stuff. And it was a real struggle. And, you know, what it's done is it's kind of dumb. It's like, say somebody came up today with some way to make jokes that was like super easy to do, and you didn't have to sit down, and it was no effort. It wasn't so much effort anymore. Anybody could be a comedian.
Right.
And anybody could have a great show.
It's called TikTok.
Well, there you go.
Our catheter implementation is TikTok.
Yes. Right. So you have to learn how to use TikTok.
TikTok is the catheter of the comedy.
Yeah, there you go. It's true, actually, you know?
It is.
And I think musicians, look what's happened to musicians.
I know.
You know, and I think TikTok is a joke. I mean, literally. And yet, but it's a different skill set. And somehow some people just lop into this and become, you know, it's crazy. So you know what that feeling is. And so I do think that my experience with my father led to certainly why I went to medical school, and certainly got me interested in neuroscience and neurosurgery, and certainly got me in vascular. But I would be lying. I don't wake up every morning trying to save my father. I mean, John Buchlar, my partner, who's really one of my closest friends, his dad died also young of an overdose of chemotherapy from leukemia. And that's what really took him off on this kind of whole clinical trial for developing safer chemotherapies. Many of us in healthcare, a buddy of mine from med school's father was a doctor who, you know, died young. And, you know, many, many doctors have these experiences with their parents and are influential, just like you had with your dad being a comedian. It's what we see every day, and it's what, you can, and plus there's got to be a genetic susceptibility to it too.
Oh yeah.
You know,
for
so
sure.
And so I my team, you know, my John and Rafael, whose father is a physician as well. He's from Puerto Rico. He's a phenomenal interventional radiologist. Griffin Baum, our young new spine guy. Jason Ellis, who grew up in Jamaica and then moved to Miami, is an only child. I went to his wedding down in Jamaica with his family. You know, every one of them has their own little story. Mitch Levine, who was the oldest of us, was a taxi driver before he went to medical school.
Mitch,
you know,
drove taxis?
Oh, yeah.
I love him in his slides and no socks. So there's a guy after my own heart.
Yeah. Yeah, so we have a great group of people. These guys are what keep me going, you know, so that I tell everybody there's no jealousy and there's no schadenfreude in our department. That we all struggle. We all fail. You know, we all have our families and we have our relationships, be there that are ongoing or the things that happen in our lives, their parents or our fathers or whatever. And we're pretty much out there and out in the open. And we recognize that those things are important to each of us.
I think it's important to have a drive that comes so deep from within. You know, not everybody has that. A lot of people, like you say in the beginning, like you said in the beginning, they go for a certain career because they want to be rich. And if you're rich without purpose, that's, I feel like that's the quickest death sentence. If you have all this money, but there's no purpose in your life or no real drive or reason to contribute, the money is, there's no value there. There's no value. Were you going to spend it on a car? To what? Drive to some stupid party with people who you don't know? So I like, that was like, for me, one of the redeeming qualities of you and your team. You honestly all feel like you come from a place of a pure drive and wanting to accomplish something because of what you've experienced. And I relate to that, as we both know. What one of the things I did was I asked my fans on the platform on Instagram to ask you some questions. Are you down to answering some questions? Because we got a whole bunch of
them. I think I can answer questions. I'll try.
Okay. Well, I can help. If you need help, just raise your hand. Oh, wow. This one's coming. Okay. K-Nep. I had a pilocytic
astrocytoma.
Yep. G1 at age grade 37.
One. Sure.
Do you think I had this my whole life?
These are pediatric tumors. They're very low grade, and you may have developed these. Probably did not develop when you're, you know, in utero, but probably it's likely you've had it for years and it just got picked up. So the answer is, life is a big number, but it probably was there for more than 10 or 15 years. At 37, you might have had it for 30 years. It developed at some point along the way, and the good news is, if you get the whole thing out, it's cured, and it's one of the astrocytomas that surgery actually is curative rather than palliative.
That's the palliative part I feel is so exhaustive for both the doctor and the patient. It just feels like you're constantly piling on other things to get to some endpoint that is inevitable. But, you know, maybe that's just me speaking from my own experience and projecting because my parents are dead. But hey, God bless tequila. Carolina Carr asks, this is a good question, I think. If you could make one invention, what would it be?
Oh, wow.
I know. Carolina.
I mean, the kind of the mechanic, something real or invent, I mean, something real or kind of totally out there.
Let's go totally out there. It's fucking Friday.
Totally out there is like a happy pill. I mean, basically, most of us, you know, we stress about what's happened in the past. We worry about the future. And most people have it pretty good. I mean, I'm not saying that everyone listen to this, but, you know, I think if we could take a pill that just basically allows us to be present and allows us to be able to eliminate some of that voice in our heads that talks to us and tells us what we're doing wrong, what we should have done, what we could have done, and to modify that, I think that would be an earth-shattering for the world. And it would really probably contribute to world peace.
I have a solution.
What's that?
We're going to
marijuana?
No, we're going to collaborate on this invention. And it's actually nature invented. It's four syllables, one word, multiple experiences through multiple dimensions. Psilocybin.
Yeah. I must say that, you know, that there is a role for this, I think, you know, potentially.
Really?
Not that I'm, oh yeah. I mean, I think that, these sorts of medications or drugs have always had a pretty, negative because they were abused and there's potentially risk. But, the answer is, I know that feeling, you know, I hear you. And, so, but it would have to be something that was safe, that all the medical experts agreed wasn't, you know, dangerous, and that you could give to children without a problem. That, and this is why it's just never going to happen. But
I would love to give my niece and nephew some shrooms and just set them out in the nature, into the woods, and see what they come up with.
Yeah. So there you go. So I mean, that's, I think, if I had to come up with invention, that would be. As far as a medical invention, I think a tool that we could cure, you know, the incurable diseases, you know, whether it's I think the one that really gets me is Huntington's disease and the neurodegenerative diseases, because it's just so disruptive. But any cancer there is.
Huntington's. I've come across that. Remind me.
It's Korea. It's like people have these bizarre movements. They can't control. They're flailing, and they can't control their movements. It's just terrible. But I actually worked with a woman named Kate Carrico. You can look that up. Kate was a most brilliant scientist I've ever worked with. I was an undergraduate medical student and resident, and she had this idea that using mRNA as a drug would work. That you could, if you could isolate RNA and deliver it, you could just create any protein that was missing in the body. And at the time, everybody was in the gene therapy and viral therapies, and we were at Penn in the 1980s and 90s when there was the Gene Therapy Institute, and it was very financially driven, perverse incentive, all the bullshit. And they ended up killing a kid during a clinical trial and shut the whole thing down. But Kate was convinced that RNA as a molecule was safe and that it could be modeled for anything, and it didn't incorporate into your nucleus or to the genome, so you could just give it, and it's like a magic bullet. And I worked with her for 10 years at Penn, and unfortunately left in 1998. My chairman, so I was supposed to stay there, but he decided to leave and come to New York. That's how I ended up in New York. Well, Kate is going to be one of the Nobel Prizes here. Her discovery of how RNA works led to the BioNTech and Moderna vaccines.
I was just going to say, isn't that the basis for Moderna and Pfizer? I mean, running through my system right now. Better fucking fix their shit, Doc.
Me too. And the other pill I would invent is a pill that basically blows up QAnon and all these anti-vaxxers and turn people into actual human again. I mean, what the hell is wrong with people? So, Kate is, I think, to me, I idolize her in a way that's, her purity and her kind of imaginative ability to overcome obstacles and being told it won't work. And now she saved the world. It's an incredible story. And her daughter, actually, who I helped get into Penn in a weird way, and she ended up rowing like I did, won 2 gold medals in the Olympics in Beijing and London, rowing.
Wow.
For the Olympics. And in fact, if you look up Kate Carrico on 30 ESPN, there's a whole piece on she and her daughter. And there's this incredible, I don't think it's ever happened before, where a family had a Nobel Prize and a gold medal.
Yeah. It's like bringing, you're uplifting a whole population and also saving one.
Yeah.
These girls should go on a tour. Seriously.
Yeah, I'm serious. But I mean, so there I've sort of seen what someone can do as far as inventing something that's really breathtakingly cool. And I've, lucky enough to have, had a small brush with that. And so the idea of being able to come up with something, that's that impactful, that could really, change the course of history as far as cancer or depression or, these terrible neurological diseases would be the invention that I think would be the most, really unique to do. And Kate's done that, really. I mean,
that's
she's
amazing.
She's going to be like Louis Pasteur or, Leonardo da Vinci kind of name historically in her contribution to science because of her persistence, her perseverance, and her intelligence. So it's possible.
It is possible. And, the word invention is a very malleable term when it comes to science and medicine specifically. Like you said, is it a physical device or is it something that is medicinal? So it is really interesting and encouraging to see women doing that, especially, up to a handful of years, we weren't allowed to do much besides makeup. So I'm excited.
Well, actually, I want to hear a great story. After Netflix came out, John Bookvar and I and our group used to have like a summer internship where high school, college, medical school kids would come and spend the summer at Lenox.
The brain
and up
turns?
Until the brain turns. You know about the brain turns?
I do. I've dug deep on your bio.
So we had 16,000 kids who signed up last year and 80% were women.
God, we're so smart. Oh my God, we're so smart.
So this
that
year
must have
we
been
did
brutal
it again.
When they all started to get their period, huh?
Woo. Oh, it was a mess. They were all cycling together.
Moon sisters.
It would be every 30 days the numbers of brain turns would drop.
Yeah, you guys have a week off according to the cycle of the women. Wow.
But we actually, this year, because it wasn't COVID, we had 12,000 registered, but we had about 2,000 kids on every Zoom, between 800 and 2,000. And we are actually having a Spanish brain turns that begins next week. But we really modified the curriculum. So we have a lot more women in medicine and, you know, things about, you know, what it's like to go through this as a woman, because, you know, in the end, healthcare remains, especially the medical side, not the administrative side, but especially the power money-making fields are very male dominated. And so if we don't make it more accessible to women, we're not going to get the best, you know, students to want to become neurosurgeons. Number one. Number two, a lot of the training has changed. You know, when I was a resident, there were no work hour restrictions. I used to go in at 5 a.m, come home at 11 at night, go back in at 5 a.m, be on call that night. You would literally eat a banana in the shower for dinner when you were home. I mean, it was just insane. And now it's 80-hour work week. So you can do things like you can have a child during your residency, during your year off. And it's more kind of human. Yet there's been a little bit of a lag in women considering these kind of more aggressive fields. But we have to do this because there's only, you know, OBGYN or, you know, dermatology. Those are great fields and they're very dominated by women, but it's because they're more accessible, not because they're more interesting. And so we've recognized that. And we're making a big push to make neurosurgery something that women would really consider doing. And it's important that we do that.
It is important because from a physiological standpoint, as we both know, the female brain and the male brain are pretty different.
Yeah.
Just from, you know, how we think, let alone on a deeper level, having women be represented in that field is something I just assumed was taken care of. And that's terrible.
About 14% of neurosurgeons are women. I think it's less than 10% of cardiac surgeons are women.
And do you attribute that to just the limited access that women have, or traditionally just the way it's been a male dominated industry, or a combination of the both?
I think it's similar to why, you know, if you look at Fortune 500 CEOs, it's only, you know, two women or something, or why there are so many fewer women senators or Congress people. There's inherent biases the way people get in, but part of it's choice. I mean, you know, I don't blame men either, by the way. It's not just the male thing. It's like women choose not to because they aren't comfortable there, or they don't think they can do it, or they aspire to it. And maybe they find they don't, not, aren't, you know, all the other thing about our field is it attracts a lot of sociopaths, you know, a lot of narcissists. And
really? Because it's neurosurgery?
Yeah, no, it's just, it's kind of the whole, I'm a brain surgeon kind of thing. And, you know, we have a tremendous amount of ego and aggressive behavior in neurosurgery and cardiac heart surgery, similar. And I think on general, there are fewer women like that, especially become doctors. I mean, there's a bell-shaped curve, all this stuff, but there are more men like that in healthcare. There are narcissistic women. They just don't, most of them don't become doctors, at least that I've seen.
No, they're my sisters.
There you go.
Just kidding. Love you guys.
Yeah. So, but the point is, I think that we have to, but there have been changes. I mean, the work hours were a huge problem, you know, initially, that it just wasn't even possible to, like, you know, survive. And it was very militaristic, egomaniacal, misogynistic, you know, the jokes in the operating room and what people say at off hours. There wasn't as nearly, no one was woke at all.
Like me making period jokes, I'd be terrible in a room.
Yeah, well, you can do it. But you know what? You do fine because you're comfortable with men. You know, the other problem is some women, and men have to be comfortable with women, being themselves in front of women. You know, you need to be able to make the same joke in front of a woman that you make in front of a man. It's just, and men, some men don't do that, you know, and women, by the same token, have to be comfortable with not being like, feel like they're put off by something that's a little off color, because now today it could really get you in trouble. I mean, I must say we are the risk benefit of this stuff is just way out. I mean, you have to be so careful in the operating room. What you used to be able to get away with, or people would just kind of laugh about, you can be fired for now.
Which I think is so crazy considering.
It is.
Nature of what you do and how delicate of an organ you're dealing with. Like you said, this isn't like any other part of the body where you can sort of get in and cut it open and slice it up and snatch it back together. the brain's a very specific organ in the way you have to slice and dice and what happens to it after you slice and dice it. You're going to fuck somebody up. You can break a leg and a bitch will walk again, but you bust a brain and they might not know their name or be able to communicate at all. So the nature of what you do is so delicate that fuck, I, in my operating room, I'd be like, you can swear. You just all look, this is a safe space, no censorship. Do whatever you need to do to keep Sally alive. Maybe put some earmuffs on her.
There's a flip side of that, though. There's a flip side of that.
Tell me.
It's my boss was a lunatic when I was training. He would throw shit. He would kick shit, scream. He'd make fun of Hillary Clinton. I mean, the guy was out of his he was out of his tree. I mean, the nurses would get all anxious. We were like,
my approach is terrible.
Yeah, well, the truth is that doesn't make it better. I mean, you know, getting upset and angry is not going to improve the situation. And I think I had to learn. I'm still working on myself, honestly, because you only make everybody around your team, you know, more anxious and more. They're not going to be as effective if you lose your shit.
Right,
so
right.
You know, in fact, we were just filming the second show, which is going to be very different than the first one. We're not going to be as front and center, John and I, and it's more about emergencies. And they were filming what's called a vascular malformation a couple weeks ago, and the thing ruptured during the filming. And I'm like, you know, so I go into like a different mode when that happens. You know, you literally have to just completely calm down, and because like there was a very well-known neurosurgeon named Robert Spetzler, who's you know, he talks about this, that, you know, you can't get upset. It's up to you. I mean, if you lose your, mind, like what's going to happen?
You're setting the tone.
Yeah. And everyone keys off you. And when they sense your anxiety, they know there's a problem. And so it takes work, and you have to like, just almost like go to a different gear. And the whole thing was recorded, like what happened. And, you know, after it was all, everything worked out fine. You know, there was a bit of a calm in the room after everything was under control. And it was like you got that on film, you know, just like, that's, I think, what it's about. It's like Sully when that airplane was, you know,
perfect example.
You know, if he freaks out, you know, you'd have 200
dead people,
done. Right?
The plane's the plane's at the bottom of the river, not floating.
Yes.
It's,
correct.
Composure's a big part.
And on top of that, I think that that's why this kind of like losing your shit is really usually some people lose their shit because they're actually not capable and they're revealed their weakness and they're not honest with themselves.
So I'm not capable to be a neurosurgeon is what you're telling me?
No, I'm not saying that.
I agree wholeheartedly. I come but in when you, when, fuck when you everybody.
Get, when you get upset about something that you're doing, think about it. It's usually because you're not in control, mm-hmm. or you're afraid what people are going to say about you or think about you.
You're insecure.
Or you're insecure. And so that's most of that stuff is coming from there.
Yeah.
Like I know in my heart, I really believe. I'm not saying it's not an ego thing. I feel like I can do anything that I need to do in the operating room. I do. And so when I struggle, you are in some really tough situations. I just tell myself in my brain, I'm like, I can do this. Like I have to be able to do this. I mean, that doesn't mean lose, you know, you have to go to that, you know, psilocybin place.
Yes. And the psilocybin place. Oh,
yeah.
Where you're just like another, a place for you. That could be a new, I don't know, maybe a center. You could have a center called the psilocybin place.
You can't do that. It's the same spot. It's just you can't use pharmacological intervention at that time.
Yet.
But you have to literally know that not the feeling, but the emotion. Like,
right, that
okay,
calm.
Everything's okay. Like,
yeah,
I'm going to be
like
okay.
Pulling in all your skills at one moment in the storm.
Storm's
yes. coming. And you've got a cellar full of shit. Do you know how to use any of it?
Yeah. Look, and we're lucky enough, like not all of medicine has those moments. Like not all surgeons, if you're a podiatrist and doing bunions, You're not gonna have that chance.
Shots fired to the podiatrist. Watch out, hey, feet docs.
It's not for everybody, you know. I mean, that's why you got to know yourself first. I mean, I think they can be very interesting. It's just, you know, you have to know your personality of floats your boat.
You know what? I have a theory about podiatrists.
What's that?
They like fucking feet.
They do. Sure.
You are a fucking riot, man. Wait. I don't want to get too far from brain turns, because there's a question about brain turns from Carolina, who asked what your invention would be, and now she wants to know about brain turns. She said,
person, two questions. What do you have, three followers?
Oh no, there's a whole bunch more here. But I because we were talking about it, I didn't want to get too far away. She said, thank you for brain turns. Will there be more of it in the future after the coronavirus?
Yeah, we did it this year. This is sort of pseudo corona. It's more like corona light this year.
Yes. Yes.
Next year, hopefully, be Budweiser. But
yeah, a total deviation from all things corona.
You know, I think we'll continue to do it. As long as there are people willing to listen to us, we'll do it. Right? Maybe we dropped the number of average this year, we dropped to about 800 or 1,000. Participants a lecture. Last year was between 1,500 and 2,000. So we'll definitely do it again next year. But if we start to show up and no one's there, we'll probably stop.
It's a smart move. I think it's a smart move. Same for my shows. Same for my tour. Yeah. I'm just going to leave.
Are you going to come to New York?
I am coming to New York. You have to bring the family.
We're having dinner.
Yes. I'm fucking for a. it. I'm going to be in New York October 9th at the City Winery.
Oh, I'll come.
Yeah, you have to come. I'll get you tickets for sure. Absolutely. Yeah. It's a wonderful
spot. It's a great spot. You're going back on tour?
I am going back on tour in a month. I have actually just was talking to my assistant and my tour manager about putting all the dates up on the site and everything.
Great.
Yeah,
I'm so excited.
Me too.
Get to meet you face to face.
Yeah, cool. That would be amazing.
That's awesome. Bring your sister.
Emily will literally die. She's texted me like 4 times since we started.
That's nice.
She texted me before. Are you guys on yet? Like, what's happening? Are you recording? Back up, okay? Save a seat for the SU game. Do you have time for a couple more questions?
Yeah, sure.
So one seems very specific, and I don't know what it is, and I feel like you'll know exactly what it is. Salamanderny says, will there ever be a cure for
glioblastoma?
Yep. $10,000 pyramid
we're
show.
We're going to play a game. You're going to say, is there a, and if I see how many letters, I can guess exactly what the question is.
I went, I said,
I have a juvenile pilocytic carcinoma. Correct.
Yeah. I would be like, I have a, I should just, you know, what's going to be funny is you and I have dinner and I'm kind of buzzed and I'm like, and you're like, dysphemiliomias. I'm like, what? I'm slurring because I'm drunk and you're blasting off things you remember from fucking medical school.
I have to go. We'll have me dinner and I'll say, I have a diarrhea. Oh, I'm sorry.
Always when I travel, 100%.
Exactly.
A cure for glucobepos.
I think so. I think so.
What
I mean,
is
it's,
it?
I don't know. You're asking me? Fuck if I know. No, let's just edit time.
No,
glioblastoma is the worst.
Clip it.
It's the worst brain tumor. Incurable. That's what Ted Kennedy died of. John McCain died of.
And why is it the worst? What?
It's
makes it the worst?
You know, if you need to make a Jello mold.
Oh yeah, I'm doing that in an hour.
Say you make Jello, and you have the clear Jello, but in the center, before it hardens, you put green Jello in. And it kind of the core is really green, but it spreads into the rest. So it's a little green, and then the green kind of goes away. When you operate on a glioblastoma, you take the really dark green part out, but you can't get everything else. It just it always sells left. And so actually, Johnny Bookvar, my partner, that's his focus, and he's come up with a really creative ways of disrupting this thing called the blood-brain barrier that blocks chemotherapy from getting into the brain. Which is inherent to the way the vessels work of the brain. And he's come up with these really creative strategies, both with catheters and with new kinds of operations, to disrupt that, to be able to get more therapies into the brain. And I think we're making progress. I mean, it's I don't think we'll cure glioblastoma in our lifetime, certainly not in mine, I don't think. But I think in our kids' lifetime, I would imagine that we will. It's a terrible, terrible, it's always, it unfortunately affects the, for whatever reason, it affects very high function people more often than most of them. It's super bad.
Assuming I'm high functioning.
Bo Biden, you know, Joe Biden's son died of glioblastoma.
Is that,
as an aside.
And now, God, I just, there's so many things when it comes to the brain that freak me the fuck out. And the thought of like basically a tumor just having this bleed out to the rest of your brain. I'm a very clean person, and to not be able to sweep up all the dust gives me extreme anxiety. And that just seems like a lot of brain dust that you cannot clean up.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know what you should do when you come to New York is come watch a brain operation. But
where do I wear scrubs?
Yeah.
Is Dr. McSteamy there?
We could arrange that.
Please.
The true story, I went to Grey's Anatomy set 3 years ago with my daughter.
Drop this in an hour in, Doc?
So a friend of mine is their medical consultant. So I took my daughter and her friends to Grey's. And we're in the kind of area where they have all like the legs and all these putty body parts. And Ellen, what's her name? Ellen
DeGeneres?
Ellen Pompeo.
I was like, DeGeneres is like, hey guys.
Ellen Pompeo and what's her, the other woman, black woman, come in. And my daughter sees them. She starts to cry. And she said, and Ellen Pompeo says to my daughter, she goes, I'm a much better doctor than your dad. I have a video of this. So, but that really happened. So you can come and we'll set you up in scrubs and you'll be all set.
That would be amazing. I would honestly love, I may have to be somewhat far away from all of the actual things that are happening. Like maybe there's a screen and I've never been anywhere near a surgery whatsoever in my life. Especially
it would
brain.
Be cool.
It would be awesome.
My wife just walked in.
Hey, wifey. What's up, girl? I love her beachwear. You're living the best life.
Yeah, we're having fun. We have two dogs, too.
How about one more question so you and your wife can enjoy your Friday?
No problem.
Okay, I'm going to let you answer the one you want to answer because there's three questions that I think are good. Okay. What do you think about Neuralink, or what are three things you can't live without, or does smoking weed every day have serious long-term effects on the brain, which I think we kind of answered.
I wouldn't smoke weed every day.
That's rude, and I feel triggered.
My wife says she would.
And I'm going to marry her. So,
No, I don't think that's a good idea, but moderation's fine. Every day's a little aggressive.
You're a doctor. You have to say that, and I respect it.
Three things. What was it? Three things
you can't live without. If three one is not your wife, who I now all of a sudden cannot live without, I'm leaving.
My wife's definitely one thing I can't live without. The second thing is probably my beach house to get the heck out of here.
You need
and,
space.
And the third thing is my partners at work. I don't think I'd want to ever, you know, leave them no matter what I do. So for sure. So that's that. And yes, I believe in Neuralink's a great technology. It's got a lot of press because of Elon Musk getting behind it, which is, you know, I think blessing and a curse. But it is the future. I mean, putting these little devices into the blood vessel, the veins of the brain, leaving them there as sort of internal sensors is a really unique concept and is likely to be really be the source of sort of the next generation of neurotherapeutics. They'll be stimulatory. They'll be diagnostic. They'll be both therapeutic and diagnostic. It's very exciting stuff. And the unfortunate thing, though, is, you know, when I went into neurosurgery, it was the beauty of opening the brain and seeing it and all the anatomy. The future is very different. We're not going to be opening the head. People are going to look back at us 100 years like, these guys are crazy. What
they were doing. You know? Yeah, taking the whole skull off.
Exactly.
You're like, right.
What were they thinking? You know?
Yeah.
So, but you know, that the because that's where we were. And we're going to get devices and technologies that allow us to do more and more without opening the head. And that's only good for mankind. And it won't be as much fun, but you know, it's certainly better for the patient than hold hard steel. So,
I honestly, I appreciate your time, and I think about what you contribute to society, and your whole approach to your life and your career is filled with so much passion and progressive thought and collaborative approach to creating solutions and betterment for people's lives. What do you want your legacy to be? What do you want to leave behind?
I want my kids to be proud of me.
That's really sweet. Yeah. I felt the same way about my dad, and I know both of our dads would be very proud of us. I mean, I am making people laugh, and you're making sure that they have the brain power to do that. So basically, you and I are saving humanity.
Yeah, in our own individual ways.
In our own individual ways. But
don't underestimate what you're doing. You're awesome. I mean, seriously, and I think seeing female comedians and taking it to the next level, that's great. You know, I think you're charting some real interesting territory. I'm sure you're aware of that. I really look forward to seeing you live and following you now on Instagram. So,
well, thank you. I mean, honestly, that means a lot coming from you, especially from the avenue, your career, and what you do with your life and your whole approach to your calling. It means a lot to hear that. So thank you so much. And I appreciate your time and seeing your beautiful wife. And if you ever mess that up, I will step right in. I'm a lesbian, but
I'll tell her.
She just sounds wonderful. Her and I will just be stoned every day at the beach house.
Yeah, she's great.
Get in the divorce. We will get the beach house.
No,
in the
she's super cool. You'd like her. She would like you too.
I bet we would love each other.
Yeah.
But thank you so much. And before we go, where can people contribute? Brain turns. Is there any information you want to promote? Where can they find you and become
Lenox
a part
Hill
of
Neurosurgery website? You can go on. We have all of our faculty there. The seven of us now are on there. We have, there's the easy play. If you want to make a donation, that'd be great. Not necessary. Send patients to us. That's the best way to donate. We're the best in the world. We really give a crap. We are empathetic and world-class, and we, intend to try to save as many people as we can. We can't do it unless patients come to us, and it's competitive to get patients. We know nobody better than us. So, please, consider us, as a sort, not just me, but our whole team. And I'm on Instagram and Twitter. I think it's like Dr. D. Langer or something like that. You know, I tend to use that. I'm on it relatively often, but you can please follow me and also Lenox Hill Neurosurgery, John Bookvar, Raf Ortiz on Twitter, Mitch Levine's on both, Jason Ellis on both. Randy D'Amico, our youngest member, is on both. He's a terrific, super great guy. And plus our team up in Westchester, Dave Gordon and Yafel Sarul. We have two women neurosurgeons, Sarai Motaval and Renee Galad. So
awesome.
Awesome. The new chairman out, North Shore, Dan Shuba, who's a superstar from Johns Hopkins. So we have a great group people we work with, and we can really handle anything. So please feel, you know, if you know of anybody who needs neurosurgery or questions, are the Northwell team in Atlanta, and whether it's at Lenox or on Long Island, it's just a great group of people.
Well, thank you so much. And cheers to you. A little tequila toast.
I only have a little left.
Well, me too.
Jessamay, you're terrific. And thank you for inviting me. And hopefully we'll see you in October at City Market.
Tickets for you guys. So, I can't wait to meet you and to not barf from behind a very thick shield of plastic or glass away from.
Yeah, you better person. Be funny. If I'm dragging my ass down there.
You better slice correctly.
You better be funny.
Thank you so much, doctor. It was great to talk to you.
Okay, bye.
Bye.